Well, I hope you do have many questions. I have loads, but of course...
Give me one of your loads of questions.
Well, one of my loads of questions concerned Asquith and this very ambivalent statement he made in 1912, saying should necessity occur in the course of the debates, there could be a separate treatment. Whatever did he mean by that? Did he mean objections during the course of the parliamentary debates? Or did he mean should something occur in Northern Ireland, or should, oh, not yet in Northern Ireland, should something occur in the streets? What did he mean? I mean, I find it so ambiguous.
It's an excellent question, Anne-Catherine, and I'm going to give a less than excellent answer. I think that Asquith is pursuing... I have always felt that Asquith's policies in 1910-1914 have often not been taken seriously by some historians who have seen him as a relatively kind of supine, a relatively lazy figure who was prepared to let things drift and to see what would happen or what would turn up. I think that there is method in Asquith's tactics, or method in his tactical madness, if I can put it like that. I think that he believes that militant unionists like Carson are seeking to apply pressure through their radical unionist activity in Ireland, their militant unionist activity in Ireland. But I think that Asquith believes that if they actually go to war, or if there is serious rioting, then the government, the Liberal government, and the Home Rule cause will have an advantage. So I think that he believes that by drawing things out, that the pressure of events will create ever greater pressure on these Irish unionists and create an opportunity for the Liberal government to do a better deal on Home Rule. I think, however, at the same time, I think that he is a pragmatic politician. I do not think that he is a convinced Home Ruler. I don't think he's a convinced Gladstonian Home Ruler like some members of his cabinet are. So I think that he's perfectly prepared to do a deal on this question if the politics work. So far as I would venture the suggestion that Asquith is not a conviction politician. He is a practitioner. He is a very smart practitioner of politics. That is not to say that he is not a man of principle. It is to say that he's fundamentally pragmatic in his practice of politics.
Yes.
About the partition of Ireland and British involvement, in this case. It makes me think that British Empire at the time tried maybe to handle the situation to prevent that it will give some ideas, I don't think of independence, but kind of distance between the countries and the high authority of British Empire.
So if I understand the question correctly, you're suggesting that British policy is about peacekeeping in Ireland and about the preservation of the empire.
Preservation of empire through the maintaining a kind of peace between the two Highlands.
Right. Again, it's a very good question and a very difficult question. I think that some scholars would agree with the suggestion that you're making, that British policy is reasonably enough about the retention of and the maintenance of British power And it is certainly the case that home rule should be seen, I think, in this light just as much as partition. Gladstone converts to home rule in 1885, 1886, and the reasons for that conversion are very, very interesting. Gladstone is a profoundly patriotic British politician, English politician with some Scottish and Welsh family connections. He sees home rule as being about maintaining Irish nationalism within a reformed United Kingdom under the best terms available. He thinks that if Irish nationalism is allowed, as the Conservatives might do, to develop without any form of self-government being granted, that this will lead to ever greater radicalisation and deliver a much more comprehensive break between Ireland and Britain than he's offering in 1885, 1886. And that's exactly what Carson means by this apparently very strange quotation that I put on the slide. Looking back at politics, I think we made a great mistake in not accepting Mr. Gladstone's first Home Rule Bill. For the most trenchant or militant unionist of the early 20th century to say, well, we should have accepted Home Rule in 1886 is superficially a curious thing. But in reality, what he's saying is that the Home Rule on offer in 1885, 1886 was such a relatively limited grant of autonomy within the confines of the United Kingdom, or in your terms, British power or the British Empire, then we should have stuck with that. So I think that you can take your point and extend it even further. Home rule itself might be seen in terms of the Liberal Party's commitment to home rule as a way of maintaining some reduced but still real form of British power in Ireland.
I didn't quite understand what you said about one of these quotations. Mm-hmm. The last one about the fact that I'd rather see a republic. Mm. So is it about Ireland as a whole, or just Ireland without Ulster, or what is considered to be?
I think that in this case, he probably means the south of Ireland, that is to say the 26 counties of the south of Ireland. And what I think he's saying is that a full-blooded republic and separation from total separation from Great Britain would be a constitutionally cleaner and therefore legally superior position than the sort of halfway house with Ireland partly independent and partly within the British Empire. That was actually the case in the later 1920s. But it's a very, you're absolutely right to draw attention to the quotation. It is a very strange quotation. And occasionally you see other unionist figures from the period talk in similar terms. And I think essentially what they mean by advocating complete separation in this sense is that unionist interests would be better protected in a fully independent Irish Republic than in the context of something like a Home Rule Parliament, which would be very closely aligned with, let's say, the Liberal Party at Westminster. And let's say Home Rule had been, let's say Asquith had been successful in getting Home Rule in 1912, 1914. And that partition had been introduced. In the south of Ireland, southern unionists such as Carson would have been effectively fighting not just the Home Rule government, but also Liberal ministers at Westminster, rather than fighting their own battles within a fully independent Dublin Parliament. I think that's what he means by this, but it's a difficult quotation, you're right.
What about the future of partition? Is it bound to be permanent or temporary?
Well,
question of the day.
again, an excellent question. I think, said this before. I have a colleague at Edinburgh who always responds to questions like this by saying that the future is not my period. The future is indeed not my specialist period. So with that significant caveat, I think that the possibilities of Irish partition, I think the best that I can say is that the possibilities of Irish partition have been heightened. There's been some recent polling evidence which is ambiguous, which points in different directions, which just adds to the uncertainty of being able to offer predictions. Historians in general are usually absolutely dreadful in future forecasting, because you can't future forecast on the basis of documents and evidence that doesn't yet exist. We also are very keen on emphasizing that history is full of contingencies, and that again militates against forecasting. But with all of those kind of defensive caveats, I would suggest that the likelihood of the reunification of the island is heightened, that Brexit to some extent has played into that. I think there's a certain amount of evidence, and this actually relates to this question as well, which was about the maintenance of British power in Ireland. While I think that it would be wrong to underestimate a successive British government's desire to maintain British unity and prestige, there is certainly a huge amount of evidence from the 19th century and beyond to underline the extent to which Ireland was very low on successive British government's priorities. The extent to which Ireland was often relegated when much more important issues came along. And to that extent, Brexit is not new. Brexit is an important, centrally important issue for English electoral politics, with potentially damaging consequences for the Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish unions, but has nevertheless been pursued because this is about the politics of the overwhelmingly dominant partner within the United Kingdom, England.
There had been another question there before, and then you'll be next.
Yeah, it was just about the Labour Party. I know it was about a very new party, relatively new, but did they play any part in the partition?
Labour to begin with, it's an excellent but complex question. So the politics of Labour in the 20th century are fluid. To begin with, Labour is much more committed to Home Rule and much more antagonistic towards Irish unionism and Irish partition than is subsequently the case. So in this period, Labour is supportive of Home Rule. Later on, however, by the mid-20th century, after 1939, 1945, after the Second World War, Labour becomes a much more pro-union party. And in the context of, I mentioned, Ireland's declaration of its republic status in 1948-1949, at that time, it's a Labour government in London, not a Conservative government, that underlines the importance of partition and gives related guarantees to the unionist-dominated parliament and government of Northern Ireland. So the short answer to your question is that Labour shifts in its... as with so much else in this question, there is no static picture. There's movement, and Labour moves from support for Home Rule in the period covered by the Agrégation towards, after that period, a more unionist position. And in some ways, it is possible to argue that the politics of class in Great Britain and Northern Ireland are actually unionist politics, to the extent that many trade unionists across the United Kingdom think that by a union-wide approach to agitation on behalf of the working classes, they can achieve greater strength than within the individual national politics. So the Scottish Labour movement and Scottish trade unionism has been effectively, quietly unionist, constitutionally unionist in that sense, as have the movements in Wales and part of the trade union movement, at least in Northern Ireland.
Other question?
Yes, I was wondering to what extent one should take identity politics into account when it comes to the relevance of partition today, because when you look at the North today, most people, the Catholics are going to outnumber very soon Protestants anyway, so the Catholics are very, very rarely unionists. So that means that in very, regardless of Brexit, is this going to be a tricky issue when it comes, I mean, identity politics are going to be that. And also the fact that in England, I mean, I have people experience, but most people don't even understand the partition at all,
yes.
Don't even know that Ireland is a separate country. So, I mean, how does that still make sense? I mean, how does history still make sense? Because people are totally uneducated about it. I mean, even people from Oxbridge don't know about it. I was really, really aghast when I was living in Britain that people don't know that at all. And certainly people in the Republic are aware of things, and people in the North as well, but it doesn't make any sense at all to talk about even the relevance of partition today, because it's not even understood by the general public in Britain, so, and not even the general public, sometimes the elite as well, sadly. So it's not really a question.
It's not a question, it's a manifesto, but it's a manifesto that I agree with. And there's a great deal there. So let me try to take the individual components as I see the individual components of the points that you've been making. So you've talked about general levels of political ignorance on the question of partition within the English metropolitan elite, and I think that that is broadly true. I think that this is also historically true. So my period is not the future, despite the question at the end of this set of slides. My period is really the period of the Union, and I and others have, you know, written on this theme of the relative ignorance of successive British ministers in terms of both Ireland as well as Scotland and Wales. So I don't for one minute doubt your advocacy on this point. You know, one isolated piece of evidence of this comes to mind, which again I think I quoted in the Home Rule book, as late as the 1970s when Edward Heath was the British Prime Minister. He was talking about the British ambassador in Dublin as being the British High Commissioner. The implication being that he thought, because High Commissioner is a title that is reserved for British Commonwealth territories, that he thought that Ireland was still within the British Commonwealth. Now, this would be not particularly shocking from somebody on the street, a woman or man on the street. This is the British Prime Minister in the early 1970s writing this in an official document. You emphasised the question of identity politics and also the demography of Northern Ireland. And you're right to do so. I recognize the importance of identity politics, but having been a professional historian for a very, very long time, I find the issue of identity within the United Kingdom extraordinarily complex. And I hesitate to suggest that fluidity and change have been one of the themes of my presentation. I'm very keen, I think, on the layering or fluidity of identity. I'm also very keen, Anne-Catherine has talked about some of the work that I've been doing on comparisons to the UK. I'm very keen on some of the... I'm very keen on deploying some of the ideas that are current in Habsburg historiography to the UK, by which I mean that you talk about identity and identity politics, and that naturally broaches the question of Britishness. But what is Britishness? Successive British ministers, prime ministers, have struggled with the notion, most recently Gordon Brown, during his tenure of the British prime ministership. Britishness is a very amorphous, a very open-ended phenomenon. I hesitate to invoke a discussion on Frenchness in a seminar of this kind, but it seems to me, as an outsider, that with France there is an idea of a centralized nation state. You have a founding event in terms of the modern French polity, the Revolution. Okay, different parts of modern France may have different attitudes towards the revolutionary achievement. And its consequences and its bloodshed, but there's a set of pivotal documents defining French citizenship from this period. Where are the British equivalents? Well, Magna Carta, 1215, I think.
It's especially tricky when it comes to Britishness in Ireland
let's take the issue of unionism in Ireland. So I think that. I'm going next week to give a talk with a very prominent historian of the Habsburg Empire called Peter Judson from the European University in Florence. And Judson is very keen on the idea of what I think the German expression is Habsburg loyalty as a binding identity within the Habsburg Empire. And to some extent, Britishness is a form of dynastic identity as well, by which I think I mean the monarchy has a central part in defining Britishness and British loyalty. Unionism and loyalism are interchangeable names, although they have a slightly different emphasis and meaning, but they're broadly interchangeable. Loyalism, loyalty to the monarchy. So I think one form of identity in Ireland is perhaps a form of overarching dynastic or imperial identity.
Post-colonial.
Yes, exactly so. And I think this is where maybe some of the analogies with the decolonization process in India and Palestine are relevant as well, where those... communities who see themselves as being distant from the mainstream national movements are struggling with the reformation of their identity of what had been a kind of, in your terms, a post-colonial set of identities in these contexts. That's all I want to say.
Well, I'd like to pursue, if I may, on this notion of identity, because that's something we've discussed, so that I've tried to get you not to discuss too much during that year. And I noted the dates you gave of the publication of The Two Irish Nations, which is quite late, 1913. So the cultural element is therefore not the driving force, but rather a subsidiary argument.
I think that the essence of unionist opposition to Home Rule until 1910 and beyond is that it is a largely all Ireland phenomenon. Now, there are shifts within that period with the increasing importance of the North in certain respects. But if you buy into a sense of a wholly politically and culturally separate North, you are by implication saying that Southern unionism doesn't matter. And unionists in Ireland don't make that step until 1913.
And thank you. That was the following question, because we tend to have a retrospective and polarized view of things. Could you tell us more about those Southern unionists, how active they were? And did they also happen to be quite eroded politically by the land transfer that was underway from the 1880s onwards?
Yes. So Southern Unionism is a mixture of land ownership, the upper professional classes. There are some small farmers in areas like West Cork, isolated communities elsewhere. There's also a Catholic unionism. Many years ago, I taught at University College Dublin. University College Dublin has a very, very proud association with the Irish Revolution. And I'm afraid it pleased me enormously to mischievously say that, remind UCD, University College Dublin, that South County Dublin, which is where I think UCD now is electorally, returned a unionist MP for most of the period that we've been discussing today. And that was partly about the Protestant upper middle classes and professional classes, but it was also about a minority Catholic unionist representation as well, because if you are a substantial merchant or professional and you're doing well in the context of the Ancien regime, you're not going to vote necessarily for revolution. So before, I think, 1910, these classes are disproportionately significant, but you rightly kind of highlighted the issue of the land question. And what you've been, at least some of you have been studying about for the aggregation and other exams, I presume, is the revolution in Irish land which occurs at this time. So there's a kind of a wider European context to this. Land values and the agricultural economies across Europe are being challenged by the opening up of a global trade in the later 19th century in agricultural produce. So the Irish economy is not absolutely unique. However, there are massive downturns in the 1870s, for example, which feed into a land war. And the British respond to this by a succession of reforms, but most comprehensively by the idea of land purchase, as Anne Katharine has quite rightly said. Land purchase is about the state supplying, if you are all tenant farmers, if you are all farmers renting your land but not owning it, and I'm your landlord, happy thought, then you... Under the land purchase legislation, you and I come to a voluntary agreement that the state will supply you with the capital to buy out your holdings. I stop being your landlord. You stop being renters. You start paying interest payments back to the government, which is acting as a kind of bank or a mortgage company, and I take all your money and take it to the casinos of Monte Carlo, where I may win, I may lose. So everybody is thought to be a gainer in this. You as tenants become now owner-occupiers, albeit with mortgages, but you're paying less to the government than you paid to me as your landlord. The landlords come out with something, and the government has a security in terms of Irish land. Getting back to the question of Southern Unionism, Southern Unionism is disproportionately landed, and in the context of land reform and land purchase, it's in retreat. So land as a political asset in this period, not just in Ireland, but also in Britain and across Europe, is being challenged. So land ownership within even the Austro-Hungarian Empire is under challenge to some extent. But landowners in the south in Ireland are being politically challenged, and that means that they're exercising less political muscle, less political strength. And that means, in turn, that their contribution to unionism is diminished. Unionism, therefore, becomes more northern in focus and strength.
So to remain in the socio-economic field, would you say that the Protestant working classes contributed, or at least influenced, the partition process? And if so, to what extent?
It is one of the features of Ireland at this time, in contradistinction to Scotland or Wales, that the Irish working classes are divided by religion and by the stand on the constitutional question. The northern Protestant working classes tend to be more sympathetic towards unionism. Catholic working classes, whether in the north or elsewhere in the island, tend on the whole to be much more sympathetic towards the idea of Irish separation, home rule, or indeed a more radical set of alternatives. So it is certainly the case that the northern Protestant working classes, who are not necessarily sympathetic to the kind of sometimes eccentric but conservative leadership of an Edward Carson, they still are sympathetic to the idea of union and sympathetic to the idea of partition, though there are some divisions on this question. And there's a set of further questions, of course, beyond this. Why should this be so? In Scotland and in Wales, it is perfectly possible to reconcile a Scottish patriotism or a Welsh patriotism within the politics of a United Kingdom Labour movement. These divisions, the divisions that exist in Belfast and in Ireland as a whole, therefore are not relevant in Wales and Scotland. How do we kind of try to explain these divisions? These are extraordinarily interesting but complicated questions. I suppose one way of approaching this very difficult question is to go back to Marxian theory, or indeed Leninist theory on the question of labour aristocracies and the extent to which labour aristocracies function as conduits of a capitalist value system politically or economically within the framework of the working classes. And I have long been attracted to that conceptual approach, although I have to say that my sympathies are as an empirical historian, and sometimes that kind of theorizing is a case of a good theory which is spoilt by the facts. So there is a sense in which, and I wrote on this many, many years ago, there is a sense in which some aspects of the intensity of unionism are actually coming from the bottom up, not from the top down. So without kind of getting into further detail, that, you know, would be one potential subversion of that approach, which I still like in terms of its elegance.
Other questions? For once, I have none immediately ready, or I can't find
I am it. Very worried by Anne Catherine's 6 pages of notes, which.
maybe I know you're not in his head or anything like this, but about this quotation, looking back at politics, I think we made a great mistake in not accepting Mr. Gladstone.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that he regretted the partition or? Like that?
I think you can. I think it's conceivable that that interpretation is true. I think that one of the challenges that we face as historians is explanation, obviously. But the corollary of that is that we are very keen on, well, elegant explanations. And no elegant explanation entirely fits Carson. The nearest that I can come to for you is, having thought about this curious individual for a very long time, is that he is to be understood primarily not in terms of politics at all, but in terms of his professional life. And he is a lawyer. And he essentially takes on the cause of unionism, Northern Unionism, 1910, 1914, as he would take on a legal client. And his duty is to get the best deal for them in the courtroom of electoral opinion that he possibly can. And that's why he moves in the way that he does. He's plea bargaining, to put it like that. Now, this is a slightly reductionist interpretation, but it has some merit. There's absolutely no question that for Edward Carson, what matters in terms of his life is actually something that we as political historians wouldn't necessarily spot immediately. That is to say, it's his professional life that matters. His professional training, his professional values, everything that he brings to the political stage hasn't been learnt in Parliament, it's been learnt in the law courts. And I think that his approach to politics is very much shaped by his legal experience. And I think at the beginning and at the end, Carson is fundamentally an all-Ireland unionist who takes on as his clients Northern Unionism and who defends them to the best of his very, very considerable abilities. One of the interesting things about studying Carson and writing about him is that he is smart. He is very, very smart, certainly as a courtroom practitioner. And his handling of his clients in 1910, 1914 is extraordinarily controversial, often actually morally dubious, but as hard-hitting, as a hard-hitting lawyer defending a complex case, it's his actions are admired even by adversaries like Asquith. Asquith is a lawyer, a courtroom lawyer, and what you find, I think, with British politics at this time is that they may disagree with Carson, but as courtroom practitioners themselves, they recognise the skill with which he had pursued his, if you like, defence case. So that's the long answer. The short answer is, I think his sympathies are as an All-Ireland Unionist, and I think his sympathies are as a lawyer.
And if I may ask a very stupid question, what was Northern Ireland in British politics by 1925? Or unionism? Because, of course, during the years 1910, 1914, and right up to partition, after all, Ulster and unionism, and I'm not exactly equating the two, were absolutely central to British politics. Did they, well, it must have been a fairly anticlimactic period, politically speaking, after partition.
I think that's true. I think that, you know, there have been a number of questions from this side of the room which quite rightly have emphasised the complex relationship between British parliamentary politics and Ireland. And I think what we're hearing, understandably, is a mixture of the desire to maintain British political authority, British imperial authority, if you like, but also there's a kind of counterweight to this, which is a profound ignorance often of Ireland and Irish politics. And we talked a little bit about Gladstone and his strategies over Home Rule, and these are partly about maintaining a lasting, if reduced, British influence in Ireland. But Gladstone is also interested, actually, in something much simpler. If I say that Gladstone is interested in getting rid of Ireland from the House of Commons, that sounds perhaps a little bit blunt, but Irish MPs, the whole kind of tenor... think of your studies of Parnellite politics, those of you who have been working in this in the early 1880s. Think of the words, think of the speeches, think of the parliamentary time that these MPs deliberately spend, taking up time designedly to demonstrate that Ireland has grievances and that these are going to impact upon the British Imperial Parliament. So one of the subsidiary motivations for getting Ireland sorted is to free up parliamentary time and free up British politics to think about other issues, non-Irish issues. So, yes, I think Northern Ireland by the mid-1920s is massively relegated. And indeed, one of the long-standing problems concerning the relationship between Northern Ireland and London is that having got rid of, if you like, at least emotionally or intellectually, Northern Ireland in this way, Northern Ireland is forgotten about.
One last quick question. No? Okay, well, if there are indeed no further questions, I think we can all thank Alvin Jackson for this contribution. Thank you.